content of this program is intended for a blind or print-impaired audience. Hello, Michael Blakely here with Religion in the News. For the next 28-odd minutes, I'll be reading articles from various news services on the subject of religion. From The Economist, first, of March 8th, a question of faith for Dutch Jews, an overdue reassurance and an ancient dilemma. Should they stress the specific threats they face, or appeal to axioms about the right of all people to be free of discrimination? Amsterdam's City Hall, built in the 1980s, sits amid what were once the dense slums of the city's old Jewish neighborhood, just off the Jodenbreestraat, Jew Broad Street, and across from the stately Portuguese synagogue. Jews began moving to Amsterdam in the 16th and 17th centuries, fleeing persecution in Iberia and Poland, and they played a crucial role in developing the city's culture of religious tolerance and political liberalism. By 1941, they numbered 79,000, a bit under 10% of the population. The city's Jewish heritage is still heard in its Yiddish-influenced slang, its nickname Mokum from the Hebrew makom, or place, and the chants of its football fans. The local team, Ajax, is popularly known as the Jews. But when Amsterdam holds its city council election on March 21st, the Jewish vote will be a negligible factor. Three-quarters of the city's Jews were murdered in the Holocaust, and by 2013, the community had shrunk to under 6,000, less than 1% of the population. Jews scored a big political gain. In a ceremony at the Jewish Cultural Center in the city, candidates representing all 10 significant parties running in the local elections signed an accord promising to honor the concerns of the Jewish community. The parties pledged to respond decisively to anti-Semitic incidents, provide security to Jewish residents and institutions, and ensure that every student in the city is taught the evils of anti-Semitism and the history of the Holocaust. "Nothing like this agreement has been done anywhere else in Europe," said Ruben Viss, secretary of the NIK, the Dutch umbrella organization of Jewish communities, which negotiated the accord. The Amsterdam Jewish Accord is patterned on the so-called Pink Accords, commitments on gay and transgender issues that the powerful COC, the leading Dutch LGBT group, has extracted from all major parties ahead of national elections for the past 6 years. The idea is to protect minorities by placing their concerns above politics. In the case of the Jewish Accord, the main initiative came from the political right rather than the left, said Paul Slotenhaar, a city council member for the VVD, a right-leaning liberal party. It is a sign of how vulnerable the Netherlands Jews feel that they decided to copy the gay community's tactics. Unlike Belgium and France, this country has experienced no terrorist attacks against Jewish targets. But Amsterdam's Jewish high school has been flanked by police guard posts since 2014. Overtly religious Jews say they are subject to harassment when they walk through ethnic Moroccan and Turkish neighborhoods. Muslims now make up about 20% of the city's population. In early December, after Donald Trump declared that the United States would recognize Jerusalem as the Israel's capital, a Palestinian immigrant smashed in the windows of an Amsterdam kosher restaurant, Ha Carmel. The Jewish community was upset not just by the vandalism, but by the police's hesitancy to install security cameras and by the allegedly lackadaisical response of the government. The grounding offense was a tweet by the leader of the country's left-liberal D66 party, Alexander Pechtold, which seemed to condemn Mr. Trump rather than the perpetrator. All of this is familiar enough story to in Jewish communities across Europe. In Sweden, after Mr. Trump's announcement in December, Muslim demonstrators targeted the local synagogue, some throwing Molotov cocktails. In Britain, the Security Community Trust, which monitors anti-Semitic incidents, recorded 1,380 of them last year, the highest number on record. In France, the attacks in Paris and Nice helped increase the already large numbers of Jews emigrating to Israel, although the stream appears to have slowed in the past year. But the issue presents itself a bit differently in Amsterdam, precisely because of the city's deep Jewish historical identity. The Jewish presence has been critical to the development of a liberal Dutch political philosophy which offers equality to citizens regardless of religion. As early as the 17th century, the Netherlands allowed an unprecedented degree of religious diversity. Today, Article 1 of the country's constitution kicks off with a promise that, quote, discrimination on the basis of religion, conscience, political orientation, race, sex, or any other grounds is not allowed. In one sense, Jewish demands toward the state are based in this universal guarantee of equal rights, the right to the same security as other citizens, regardless of faith. On the other hand, the fact that today's tensions stem largely from the encounter of a small Jewish community with growing immigrant Muslim groups means that Jewish demands toward the Dutch state are often phrased in more specific terms, stressing the community's distinguished past and unique vulnerability. They sometimes appeal not to universal rights, but for special consideration for Amsterdam's Jewish heritage, as in the preamble to the accord, which evokes, quote, 400 years of Jewish history in Amsterdam, and in its pledge that some form of education about the Holocaust will be mandatory for every city resident. And these demands are often accompanied by condemnations of illiberal, chauvinistic, or anti-Semitic currents among Muslim newcomers. These tensions come to a head during a debate between municipal candidates at the Jewish Community Center after the signing of the accord. Things grew heated during a confrontation between Zeger Ernsting, a council member of the Green Left Party, and Annabel Naninga, a journalist and candidate for a new populist right-wing party called Forum for Democracy. Ms. Naninga attacked the Green Left, a powerful force in the city, for maintaining links with Muslim groups whose anti-Zionism edged into anti-Semitism. Mr. Ernsting said he criticized those groups' bigotry as well, and that his condemnation of anti-Semitism was linked to the constitutional ban on all discrimination. He asked whether Mrs. Naninga saw anti-Semitism as simply a problem of Islam. Ms. Naninga said yes, she saw the contemporary problem of anti-Semitism in Amsterdam as, for the most part, a problem of the Muslim community, and that it would be otherworldly to pretend otherwise. That drew applause from the more conservative segments of the audience. Such arguments leave ordinary Dutch Jews, like their counterparts elsewhere in Europe, with a dilemma as they campaign for the protection they still need in places where they are, forever and without reason, subject to persecution. Should they stress the specific threats facing their community, or should they appeal to universal axioms such as the basic right of all people to be free of discrimination? In some ways, this conundrum is as old as Judaism itself, a religion whose oldest writings and prayers emphasize both the distinctiveness of the Jews and a longing for all nations to acknowledge and receive God's blessing. The liberal strain in Jewish thought, to which Amsterdam contributed so much, would insist that universal principles should never be forgotten. And from the Religion News Service now of March 9th, just over 5 years ago, a Saudi-financed Center for Interfaith Relations opened in Vienna amid concern that it might be a public relations fig leaf for a country often slammed for its lack of religious freedom. Since then, the reformist Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who could reign over the Desert Kingdom for decades if he takes over as planned from his elderly father King Salman, has raised hopes that the tight grip of the ultra-conservative religious establishment on the country is loosening. In October, Salman, age 32, said he wants to return his country to, quote, a more moderate Islam open to the world and all religions. This cautious opening has been a boon to the Saudi-backed King Abdullah bin Abdulaziz International Center for Interreligious and Intercultural Dialogue, or KCID, in Vienna. Its mission to improve relations between religious groups sounds more credible now that its main backer is starting to open up. Staunchly conservative Saudi Arabia, which prohibits the construction of churches and synagogues, has long been anything but moderate in religion. Especially in recent decades, it has enforced strict limits on women's rights, banned cinemas and other public entertainment, and tightly controlled religious activity by any faith other than its official Wahhabi Islam. That has been changing under the Crown Prince's Vision 2030 reform program that aims to wean Saudi Arabia off its economic dependence on oil, diversify its economy, and roll back the ultra-conservative religious hierarchy's near veto power over domestic and foreign policies. In Vienna, after a rocky start, the Interfaith Center has launched several programs promoting harmony among world faiths and seen Riyadh starting to get into step with its message. This has helped establish it as a serious player in interfaith dialogue. It took us some time to build up trust, to break down psychological barriers, and have the stakeholders accept us, said KSIDS Secretary General Faisal bin Abdulrahman bin Muammar. He told Religious News Service during a recent conference in Vienna, "We went through good times and bad times in the past 5 years, but in this year I think we started receiving the fruit of what we planted," he said. King Salman and Prince Mohammed have a strategy to move Saudi Arabia ahead, and we are benefiting from this. Mohammed bin Salman, who is now on a diplomatic tour of Europe and is due to visit the United States on March 19th, unveiled Vision 2030 reforms in 2016. In an interview with London's Guardian newspaper, he said that Saudi Arabia had turned ultra-conservative in reaction to the 1979 Islamic Revolution in nearby Shiite Iran and was, quote, not normal since then. During that period, Riyadh tightly policed its puritanical Wahhabi version of Sunni Islam at home and exported it to Muslim communities abroad by bankrolling mosques, imams, and schools that many Western governments suspect may have spread extremist views. In recent months, the kingdom has reined in its notorious religious police, reopened its once banned movie theaters, and announced women would soon be able to drive. It's still very conservative, but it's starting to evolve. Lebanese Maronite Patriarch Bekara Boutros al-Rahi, one of the high-level participants at the February 26-27 conference, said he discussed the reform plan with the Crown Prince in November. The Patriarch's trip to Riyadh was itself a rare act of openness for Saudi Arabia, which hosts Islam's holiest sites and bans the public practice of other faiths. "It will take time, and it won't be easy," said al-Rahi, an Eastern Rite Catholic who is also a cardinal. "But the fact that a patriarch is invited by the king and treated like a head of state is already a sign that things are changing." Rabbi David Rosen, who represents Judaism on KSIDS's board of directors, said he also expected to be invited to Saudi Arabia for a meeting of the board there. "It should happen sometime soon," he said. The Vatican's representative, Bishop Miguel Ayuso Guichot, said the changes in Saudi Arabia so far were timid but positive and could help the many Christians working there. They cannot now have churches and must worship in private quarters. "We are happy to hear that the social discourse shows openness and a willing to change Saudi society," he said. "We have to be positive." A subtle but significant sign of change was the way Middle Eastern Islamic leaders at the conference backed its goal of, quote, promoting peaceful coexistence and common citizenship. That wording implies equal rights for religious minorities, not the second-class dhimmi status that is supposed to protect them in Muslim societies. The Grand Imam of Mecca, Grand Muftis of Egypt, Lebanon, and Jerusalem, the heads of the World Muslim League, and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, as well as Riyadh's Deputy Islamic Affairs Minister, all attended and addressed the conference. Skepticism was widespread in 2012 when KSIDS opened its doors in the refurbished Starinae Palace, just down Vienna's elegant Ring Road from the headquarters of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, saying it wanted to promote understanding among religions. Critics dismissed it because of Saudi Arabia's dismal record on religious freedom, and local politicians charged it might be used to spread radical Islam in Austria. Senior officials of other religions who signed on as directors and advisors openly said that they would quit if they felt they were being manipulated. The center went through a crisis in 2015 when former Austrian Justice Minister Claudia Baudin-Aurtner, its deputy head, tried to play down public criticism of the flogging of a dissident Saudi blogger by saying the Saudis, quote, don't chop off heads every Friday. She soon had to step down, and Austria temporarily considered withdrawing its sponsorship. But Caeseed survived and focused its work more on fostering local interfaith dialogues. In recent years, it has brought together leaders of 16 Muslim and Christian religious faculties across the Middle East to work on a common curriculum for training students in interreligious dialogue. Its International Fellows Program provides a year-long training in dialogue for about 45 educators from different faiths to make them multipliers of the message. For most, it was the first time to meet someone of faiths they knew nothing about or to visit those houses of worship, said 2016 fellow Rabbi Jeff Berger of Montfiore College in London. Caeseed has also involved itself in what one participant called the toughest cases, trying to promote dialogue across tense religious lines in Nigeria, Myanmar, and the Central African Republic. In Europe, it is helping Muslim and Jewish leaders form a joint council to lobby against governments that want to ban circumcision or ritual halal or kosher slaughter. The Vienna conference includes the official launch of a pioneering platform to foster interreligious contacts in the Arab world, with Caeseed pledging to develop programs to promote dialogue among faiths, mainly Muslims and Christians, in the region. Caeseed is officially an international organization with Saudi Arabia, Austria, and Spain as its sponsors, and the Holy See as a founding observer. Riyadh initially funded it for the first 3 years and has continued since then. The support we are getting from King Salman and the Crown Prince is unlimited, financially and politically, bin Muammar said, adding that Riyadh's reforms were an additional boost. Kauthar Musa Al-Abash, a Saudi blogger and member of the kingdom's advisory Shura Council, said the Vision 2030 program, quote, sped up some legislation that might have taken 50 or 60 years to see the light. Nowadays, the moderate voices are much louder than the extremist voices, she said. There will always be opposition, but it won't have the same effect as it would have years ago because the moderate voices are the louder ones now. An Arab Christian cleric, requesting anonymity to avoid appearing nearly overly critical, welcomed the Saudi reforms and the boost they gave to Caeseed, but insisted that he had to be seen in context. Remember, this is the 21st century, and they're just now getting around to talking about letting women drive. And back to the Economist now of March 9th. A point of principle. Why a Mennonite woman has refused to testify in a death penalty case. Mennonites eschew the state and its executioners. Religious freedom, as it has been defined recently in domestic American affairs, is a cause that mostly attracts conservatives. Its heroes include Kim Davis, the Kentucky cleric who was jailed after refusing to authorize same-sex marriages, and Jack Phillips, the Colorado baker whose refusal to prepare a cake for a gay wedding is being mulled by the Supreme Court. But in the last few days, the cause of liberty of conscience has acquired a champion who will appeal to the political left, Greta Lindekrantz. She's a 67-year-old woman who has gone to jail rather than give evidence in a case where her testimony might make a difference to whether a man is ultimately put to death. Her refusal is rooted in her Mennonite faith, and it follows prayerful deliberations with her church and pastor in Inglewood, Colorado. She was declared in contempt of court on February 26th after declining to answer questions from the prosecution in the case of Robert Ray. He is appealing against a death sentence imposed in 2009 for the killing of a witness who was due to testify against him in an earlier murder trial. Mr. Ray is arguing that his original defense lawyers were ineffective, a claim the prosecution wants to disprove. Ms. Lindekrantz worked as an assistant to the original defense team, and the prosecution wanted her to answer questions about the team's work. Colorado's Catholic bishops, despite their theological differences with the back-to-basics Mennonite creed, have backed Ms. Lindekrantz. They said that she, quote, should not be punished for her religious beliefs and convictions regarding the death penalty and the taking of human life. The Catholic Church opposes capital punishment, a stance which, along with its generous views on migration, appeals to liberals. As for the Mennonites, they are difficult to place in any conservative-liberal continuum. Some of them are as culturally conservative as any person alive in the 21st century could be. but their detachment from earthly powers, and especially from the use of force by earthly powers, can make them progressive heroes. In some ways, this stance of Miss Lindencrantz perfectly exemplifies the ethos of the Mennonites, a denomination with roots in medieval Germany that proclaims a return to the fundamental principles of the New Testament, which it believes to include an absolute rejection of violence. Insofar as they are active in politics, it is generally in the cause of nonviolence. Mennonites of the more worldly variety lobby the American and Canadian governments to reduce military spending, and they oppose the practice of executions in America and in all other countries. One of the most visible Mennonite initiatives consists of so-called Christian peacemaker teams, who have won respect by trying to defuse tensions in hotspots like Colombia, Iraq, and the West Bank. But as is explained by Royden Lowen, a professor of Mennonite studies at the University of Winnipeg in Canada, this is a religious movement which hesitates deeply before getting involved in any form of political or public affairs. Its ranks include the Amish people, best known as a farming community in Pennsylvania, which retains the clothing, material culture, and German dialect of pre-industrial Central Europe. Also within the Mennonite fold are more acculturated members who lead conventional urban lives but are guided by what they regard as biblical principle. These include a rejection of infant baptism, that was the defining feature of the Anabaptist movement from which all Mennonites sprang, and the quietist but standoffish attitude toward earthly authorities. It is an attitude which on one hand accepts that earthly powers have been ordained by God, but also insists that Christians, as individuals or communities, shouldn't have too much to do with these worldly institutions. The professor, now 63, recalled that as a young Mennonite, he applied for a job with Canada's Department of Indian Affairs and immediately balked when his employers asked him to swear an oath to Queen Elizabeth, Canada's sovereign. Fortunately, they were happy for him to make a simple affirmation of his intent to provide good service. As for Ms. Lindencrantz, one of the most unusual features of her story is the very fact that she was acting as an assistant investigator for a legal defense team. For some Mennonites, acting in that role, however disinterested or noble the intention, would be an excessive entanglement with the powers and processes of this world. From the Associated Press now of March 9th, Christians emerge as key patrons for Jews moving to Israel. Israel's founding fathers, who etched a commitment to encouraging Jewish immigration into the Declaration of Independence, might be surprised to find that 7 decades later, the state is relying on Christians to fulfill that promise. What was once a strictly Jewish-funded mission is increasingly being bankrolled by evangelical Christians. Israel's Christian allies now fund about a third of all immigrants moving to the country, according to a tally by the Associated Press. The figures reflect the ever-tightening relationship between Israel and its evangelical Christian allies, whom Israel has come to count on for everything from political support to tourism dollars. After 2,000 years of oppression and persecution, today you have Christians who are helping Jews, said Rabbi Yishiel Eckstein, a president of the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, a group that raises money from evangelical Christians for Jewish causes. This is an amazing thing. Israel has long depended on diaspora Jewish communities, especially in the United States, for donations and to lobby their local governments on its behalf. But evangelical communities have become increasingly important. Israeli charities raise millions of dollars from Christians around the world, and evangelical Christians make up 13% of all tourists to Israel. The Parliamentary Caucus works with evangelical legislators around the world to foster support for Israel. Israelis can also thank white evangelicals for helping to put President Donald Trump, an ardent supporter of Israel's nationalist government, in the White House. Israel has no better friends, I mean that, no better friends in the world than the Christian communities around the world, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told a Christian media summit in Jerusalem last year. European and American Jewish philanthropists championed immigration to Israel, known as Aliyah, or Ascending, even before the creation of the state in 1948, by working to settle Jews in what was then Ottoman and British Palestine. In the decades after independence, The government partnered with Jewish groups to organize dramatic airlifts of Jews from troubled countries. Christian support for the Aliyah had largely began with the collapse of the Soviet Union and has grown in recent years as American Jews have redirected charitable donations to niche causes. That has forced nonprofits to expand their pool of benefactors. We don't see any reason why not to rely on help, including donations from all our friends around the world, be they Jewish, Christian, or others, said Yigal Palmore, a spokesman for the Jewish Agency, a nonprofit that spearheads Jewish immigration to Israel. The Israeli Ministry of Aliyah and Immigrant Absorption, however, said it has no ties to Christian groups. Of the more than 28,000 Jews who immigrated to Israel in 2017, at least 8,500 arrived thanks to Christian donations, according to official figures and numbers provided by the Fellowship and Jerusalem's International Christian Embassy, another prominent group that raises money from evangelicals. The Jewish Agency receives additional undisclosed funds from other Christian donors, meaning that share could be even higher. Not everyone is pleased. Some in Israel are suspicious that the evangelical embrace stems from a belief that the modern Jewish state is a precursor to the apocalypse, when Jesus will return and Jews will either accept Christianity or die. Liberal Jews, who make up the majority of American Jewish community, bristle at the evangelicals' ties to the political right and their support for Israel's settlement enterprise in the West Bank, a major sticking point in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Jeremy Ben-Ami, president of J Street, a liberal pro-Israel group in Washington, said the Jewish community should be, quote, wary of taking help from those who are playing with our lives to further their own religious and ideological purposes. Evangelical Christianity is one of the fastest-growing religious movements, making up more than a third of the world's estimated 2 billion Christians. Evangelicals say their affinity for Israel stems from Christianity's Jewish roots. Some view Israel's establishment as fulfilling biblical prophecy, ushering in an anticipated messianic age. Jews also believe in a future messianic age, but do not believe in Jesus as the Messiah. It's a connection. It's a DNA that goes back to Sunday school, to their very being. It's a love affair. It's a romance with a nation that's connected to heaven and earth, said Mike Evans, an evangelical Christian who sits on Trump's Evangelical Faith Advisory Board. In recent years, suspicions have diminished in Israel, thanks in part to the steady flow of donations, as well as evangelical representatives playing down talk of the end of days. They say it is not a central tenet for most of the world's evangelicals, or what makes them love Israel. Johnny Moore, the Faith Board spokesman, said the skepticism over evangelical support was ignorant and offensive. The International Fellowship of Christians and Jews says it gave $188 million to the Jewish Agency over the course of a two-decade-long partnership, with Eckstein even sitting on the agency's executive board. But after disagreements over how to publicize the fellowship's support, the two had a falling out, and the fellowship struck out on its own in 2014. Its own Aliyah project has since ferried thousands of Jews to Israel from 27 countries, providing them with financial assistance beyond that extended by the state, as well as vocational training and assistance with local bureaucracy. Religion is religion. You can believe whatever you want, but people need help. They need help, they said. Well, that's about all the time we have now for Religion in the News. This has been Michael Blakely. I'll talk to you later.